from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. War may be hell, but it has actually made humanity safer and more prosperous. That's according to Stanford University history professor Ian Morris. He'll join us to talk about his latest book, War, What Is It Good For? Conflict and the Progress of Civilization from Primates to Robots. And later in the hour, we check in with filmmaker Ken Burns about his new documentary on President Lincoln's Gettysburg Address and its contemporary relevance. Join us for Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's Forum program. And in this second hour, we welcome British-born Stanford professor of classics in history, Ian Morris, a historian as well as an archaeologist and a one-time aspiring heavy metal guitarist who now lives in the Santa Cruz Mountains and who authored Why the West Rules for Now, the winner of the 2011 Penn Award for Creative Nonfiction. His newest book is called War, What Is It Good For? And he takes us through 15,000 years of history in a discourse which attempts to answer that question that's in the title. The conclusion he comes to will seem immediately counterintuitive. It turns out that war is tied ultimately, in Professor Morris's research, to a decrease in violence, greater safety, and economic growth. Ian Morris joins us in studio for this morning's second hour. Welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me on the show.
Glad to have you. And I guess let's start with just this whole broad canvas that you have, because it may be startling to some people to realize that when you think of the 20th century, which is always heralded as the most violent and most full of death century of them all, with the A-bomb and genocide and two world wars and need we go on, government-orchestrated famine, mm-hmm. and add a few things to that, cultural revolution. Still, only 1-2% of the people died violently of the whole population, as opposed to the Stone Age, where it's 10-20%. So you got to kind of grapple with that to start off thinking the way you're thinking.
Yeah. Sometimes when you shift from the kind of scale of everyday experience up to these really big global pictures, it's difficult to put the two together and to sort of get your mind around the numbers. Because probably, I mean, you're quite right to say the 20th century is the bloodiest in history. Probably something like 100 to 200 million people die violently around the world. But on the other hand, something like 10 billion people live during the 20th century. So it's somewhere in the 1-2% range, as you say. And when we look back 10,000 years, for a long time, there was this very influential theory that humanity in the state of nature lived this idyllic life and nobody ever fought with each other. Everybody got along just great. Pretty clearly, there's still some debates, but pretty clearly now this is just not the case. That there's just a lot of scope to use violence to settle your disputes if you live in a Stone Age society with very few real rules and just a lot of people dying.
Yeah, well, Steven Pinker came up with the same hypothesis, and I guess we've seen this worked out. But the idea that war somehow has made us safer, now that's a pretty new and innovative idea, that societies are created by war, because bigger societies are created, they're more complex societies, and I guess governments have stamped out internal violence, and that's pretty much been the pattern.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I mean, and Steven Pinker's book, I think, is a tremendous study of like how this has unfolded, particularly across the last 500 years. And then he contrasted, looks back to the Stone Age for a little bit as well. What I try to do in my book, which I think is a bit different, is to tell this as a continuous historical story across the last 10,000 years, which I think brings out all kinds of other patterns as well. And in one way, of course, like all authors, I like to think that what I'm saying is all super original. Nobody's ever seen this before. But actually, of course, this is a really old argument. And in some ways, the arguments I'm making are not so wildly different from what Thomas Hobbes was saying back in the 17th century.
Now, you mentioned Hobbes. Of course, immediately think of Spanned from Womb to Tomb and Life is Nasty, Brutish and Short and all that. I mean, pretty pessimistic. And I love the way you use this binary of Hobbes and Rousseau in your book, the noble savage idea of Rousseau, where the, you know, we're pretty much the product of our institutions and we're basically noble at heart. But the idea that let's go back to Hobbes, that wars produce these leviathans, a famous book of Thomas Hobbes, and the leviathans are what make us safer and what make us richer.
Yeah, this, I think, is the picture that comes out very clearly when you look at the big historical story across the whole world. Starting the end of the Ice Age, really, about 10,000 years ago, the world warms up, obviously, which is why it's the end of the Ice Age. The world warms up, and population starts to grow, particularly in a band of latitudes from China over to the Mediterranean. And this really changes things as the world gets more crowded. Now, if two groups of people get into a big fight with each other, in the old days, in the days of hunter-gatherers, you could just move away and hunt and gather somewhere else if you lost. But as farmers multiply and there gets to be more and more crowding in the world, you can't do this so easily anymore. So you get this new phenomenon coming into the world where the winners of wars will swallow up the losers into larger societies. And this plays out across the next 10,000 years. But a weird thing then happens. Like, if you are the ruler of the society that won the war and you've swallowed up these other guys, to make this bigger show work, you've got to have more complex, more centralized organization and government. To make that work, you know, you're competing with all these neighbors who are also doing the same thing. What you really want out of life, if you're the ruler, is you want your subjects to get up in the morning and go out to their fields and work hard and generate wealth, which they then use to pay taxes to you so you can get on with the important ruler things like fighting other rulers and having thousands of virgins in your harem or whatever it is you want. What you really don't want is all your subjects running around smashing each other in the head and burning each other's farms down every time they have a dispute.
So you want order.
Exactly, yeah. You come under which is sort of what Hobbes said. You come under this pressure that the further you move toward a peaceful society under your rule, the more likely you're probably going to do. And of course, thousands of exceptions, this really big trend we're talking about. But over 10,000 years, over the entire planet, it's had this totally unexpected side effect that rates of violent death have fallen by about 90%.
Although supposedly mass populations are supposed to be more of a catalyst to violence, and as people are crowded together, more catalyst to violence and all that. But I'm wondering, since we talk about the division between Hobbes and Rousseau, which you talk about quite lucidly and I think is quite important, there's also the division that you point out between chimpanzees and bonobos. I mean, to some extent, it's always been assumed, I remember reading Conrad Lorenz as a kid, we're territorial and that we fight by nature and that we have this within us. And chimpanzees certainly are a wonderful example of that, as you point out in your book. I mean, killing and raping another group of chimpanzees, as Jane Goodall observed. But then you have the bonobos, the peaceful, loving. It's almost like the better angels of our nature, as Steven Pinker suggests. So where does evolutionary biology fit into this pattern that you're working on here?
Yeah, I think it plays a really important part in trying to understand what the big story is telling us. I think a lot of the thinking about this problem has been very binary. I mean, as you say, you've got Hobbes versus Rousseau, and you've got the guys who study the chimps versus the guys who study the bonobos, and everybody fights with each other, argues with each other constantly over what this is telling us. I think, though, as very often turns out to be the case, that the best answer tends to lie somewhere in the middle. I think what we learn from the biologists is, as you're saying, back in the 1970s, Jane Goodall, after winning fame and fortune by going on these National Geographic shows and showing the world how lovable all these chimps are, to her horror, she discovers that one of the two communities she's studying is waging a genocidal war on the other. And over 4 years, they beat to death all the males in the neighboring group. They beat and rape all the females. They kill some of the females, abduct the others, and they take over the hunting range of the group that just got destroyed. And so everybody starts running around saying, this proves we've evolved to be violent. We're hardwired to be killers. But then 15 years later, in the mid-80s, on the other side of the Congo River, which is too wide for apes to swim, primatologists discover that bonobo chimpanzees are about as opposite as you can possibly imagine. That if two bands of bonobos run into each other in a clearing in the forest, there's a very good chance it's going to end up in an orgy of every kind of age and sex group all mixing it up
together. They're the most polymorphous, highly sexual creatures, I think, maybe on the planet, other than human beings of some sort.
Desmond Morris, who wrote The Naked Ape back in the 1960s, he liked to say that humans are the sexiest primates alive. But that was before people had really got on top of the bonobos.
That's interesting. Bonobo as or bonobo?
Well, I've heard both. I mean, I'm not a primatologist, so I tend to go with whatever the last pronunciation I heard was.
Well, you tomato, tomato. You keep yours, I'll keep mine. You've actually got your whole little lexicon here from you define this whole canvas of yours as from glob to now, and talking about glob cops and Denmark. Define what sort of the lexicon you're using here is.
Yeah, well, I think one of the big trends we can see, again, if you go back 10,000 years to the end of the Ice Age, you're dealing mostly with very small groups of people, a dozen or so people living together, very fluid relationships. And once you get into a caged world where there isn't much room to move around anymore, the violence starts to have this unexpected side effect, and you get the creation of bigger and bigger organizations. And I think by the late 18th, certainly by the 19th century, you've gotten to the point where the organizations, the societies that have been created through war are now so big, like the European empires that are beginning to form, so big they're spanning across continents and entire oceans are being linked by them. And I think by, say, about 1815, after the British defeat Napoleon at Waterloo, you can really begin to talk about there being a globocop, basically, like a super leviathan who oversees an international order. And 19th century Britain, of course, generates much of its spectacular wealth comes from overseeing these global flows of trade. And this is what Adam Smith sees in the 18th century, that the real wealth of nations, he says, doesn't come from conquest and plunder. It comes from overseeing the market, and your government must get out of the market so the market can flourish and people can truck and barter. But at the same time, he also recognises that markets can't work at all unless governments get into them and provide an even playing field and enforce the rules. And by the 19th century, Britain is able to act as a kind of global policeman, driving down the rates of violent death and at least beginning to raise global standards of living. And then, of course, many would say that nowadays the US has replaced Britain in this role.
Well, this is one of the things that's really quite fascinating, because in your book you point out that Pax Britannica, as that began to fade, the sun will never shine on the British Empire, suddenly we had two huge world wars, and now we're kind of in Pax Americana phase.
Yeah. Well, at the end of the book, I try to draw together some lessons from this big history that we've had the last 10,000 years. And seems to me there is one really big implication in this story, that in the past, the only way we've really found to drive down rates of violent death, creating a peaceful world that also creates the preconditions for rising standards of living, the only way we've found to do that has been through violent conflicts that lead to somebody becoming the Leviathan or ultimately becoming a globocop. In the late 19th century, we see this sort of weird, paradox comes out of British globocopery, which, Britain generates its wealth by overseeing the great flows of trade around the world. In order to do that, it's got to have foreign customers rich enough to buy its goods and services. So Britain is kind of in the business of helping other countries get rich, because that helps Britain get richer still, which is, economically is fantastic for Britain, but strategically it's this huge problem, because by the 1870s, the US and Germany have gotten so rich and successful that they are beginning to become rivals to Britain. So it's like the better Britain does at being a globocop, the harder it comes for Britain to be a globocop. And I think in some ways you could maybe say something rather similar has been going on since the 1980s with the US. We've seen the spectacular growth of Chinese wealth and power in particular, although other countries too, to the point where now a lot of people are starting to say, well, it's getting harder for the US to continue in this role as globocop.
And Denmark would be the ideal. I mean, as opposed to Switzerland, which is where one often associates peace and neutrality.
Yes. Yeah, I don't know quite why Denmark got picked on as the ideal, but it did. And at some point,
Danish population every year comes out on the happiness index as highest.
You
cradle to tomb.
You go there and they all seem pretty miserable to me. But about 30, 40 years ago, political scientists started using this catchphrase about getting to Denmark, saying that this is the goal. That we want to take dangerous, chaotic societies, Somalia, Sudan, Afghanistan, you pick your favorite dangerous society. If we can get them to Denmark, like a sort of mythical place where the rule of law prevails and rates of violence are low and prosperity is high and democracy is flourishing, that should be the goal for people in international relations.
Well, I remember a long time ago reading Gerald W. Johnson, who I used to read regularly in the New Republic as a boy, and he talked about how essentially, it was before the idea of mutually assured destruction took hold, at least on Western consciousness. He said, you know, eventually we're going to be able to have so many nukes that we can't afford to go to war. And you talk about being in Cambridge and realizing you could have been vaporized with one of these yes. kind of stories that Eric Schlosser tells us in his new book, all these declassified stories just about how close we mm-hmm. came on a number of occasions, the sort of thing that would keep you awake at night, to put it mildly. But now we have all these nuclear weapons, and now, you know, they're stateless foes and adversaries to have to worry about. So the whole global picture has changed, hasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Political scientists often like to say that, you know, the old Cold War world was scary but stable, that there were enough nuclear weapons. In the high point in 1986, there were 70,000 nuclear warheads in the world. Just mind-boggling number. And
we're about 90% down of that.
We are, exactly, yeah. I think more than that. I think it's 95%. The good news is we no longer have enough nukes to kill everybody.
Yeah, but the bad news is everybody's still proliferating.
Yeah, this is the thing. You're comparing with the Cold War again. The old system was really scary, but it was very stable, especially after 1962, after the Cuban Missile Crisis. People are beginning to work out how we can not destroy each other, how we can avoid blunders. But now we've got this very different situation where a lot fewer nukes, but dispersed around a lot more countries. And a lot of countries are now, let's say India and Pakistan, I think, are a great example. They don't have a mutual assured destruction relationship. They don't have enough weapons to annihilate each other, but they perhaps have enough weapons that a first strike, you know, attacking the enemy's nuclear weapons without warning, first strike perhaps could work. And this, again, it's like the worst of all possible worlds here. The temptation, you know, if something went wrong in their relationships, the temptation to go nuclear seems to be pretty high.
Well, but also, as I said, there are stateless entities now, mm-hmm. and that's... something that we never would have imagined. Al-Qaeda, bin Laden, before he died, said, you know, that his biggest ambition was to get a hold of a nuke
yeah.
and to be able to use a nuke.
Yeah, it's a different kind of risk from what we, you know, old guys like me, were familiar with during the Cold War. That now... I mean, I guess the good news is, you know, Al-Qaeda, in any imaginable scenario, there's no way they can begin to be as dangerous as the Soviet Union was, or even as, you know, as Iraq would have been, say, if Saddam Hussein had had nuclear missiles. That they potentially, in the worst-case scenario, a terrorist organization could get hold of one or two nuclear weapons. It could kill many millions of people. But the war games that the US ran in the mid-80s on what will happen if we get into an all-out exchange with the Soviets, they kept hiring different consultants to come in because they didn't like the results. And the consultants all came out in the same place. So we should expect, first couple of weeks, roughly a billion dead. And then after that, it becomes almost impossible to predict what the sort of second effects from disease and starvation will be. And you know, the non-state actors can't take us back to that unless... what they did had a sort of Franz Ferdinand type effect, that you know, one guy shoots the Austrian, the heir to the Austrian throne, World War I starts. If a terrorist organization could commit an outrage that then pushed states to go to war with each other, then we could be back talking to the hundreds of millions dead again.
On the other hand, Russians were buzzing a warship just yesterday. Very perilously mm-hmm. close, and it was fraught with all kinds of concern. We're talking to Ian Morris, professor of classics and history at Stanford, and the author of a new book, which is called War, What Is It Good For? Conflict and the Progress of Civilization from Primates to Robots. And we're going to give you an opportunity, certainly, to join in this conversation. But I remember reading something about you saying maps, not chaps. I'll get into this a bit with you from your historian hat. Mm-hmm. I mean, the idea that individuals influence history has long been with us, or that, you know, Napoleon and the desire for war and conquest and so forth is really often behind wars. Francis Fukuyama, I think, came out with a critique against your work saying, you know, you really didn't take into account the importance of ideas enough. You were too material, too mm-hmm. much against the idea of individuals. But individuals have been an enormous influence. I mean, you talk about Hitler or Trump being Hobbes, or mm-hmm, you put
yes.
those two together, for example, and raise this whole question, and it's a fascinating question. If Hitler had been killed and we hadn't gone into World War II, then what would have been
yeah.
The outcome? Maybe the consequence could have been worse for mankind, but one thinks obviously not.
Yeah, well, this is something I've been thinking about a lot, really, in the last 10 years or so, as I started off in my academic career. Fairly mainstream stuff. I was a specialist on the early Iron Age in Greece, about 1,000 to 500 BC. I was doing very, very detailed work. But then, over the years, the kind of problems I've been interested in have gotten bigger and bigger and bigger. And one of the things that really struck me as I started to look across thousands of years on the entire planet was the way that the role of individuals, the role of culture, all kinds of other things, the way that changes depending on the scale of the problem you're looking at. Like, so if we ask a question like, why did World War I break out? Which, of course, in this centenary year, so many people are asking. To understand that, you need to know a lot about geography and strategy, but you also need to know an awful lot about the details of what's going on in 1914.
You also need to know a lot about nationalism.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, a lot of detailed stuff. But if you zoom out from that to the sort of question I'm posing in this book, War, What Is It Good For? Looking at 10,000 years of history, what I find is that most of the time, the sort of accidents, the individual stuff, it kind of comes out in the wash over the long run. The picture begins to look much more like the kind of picture that, say, a biologist would see if they're studying an animal species. Like, say you're an expert on rabbit evolution or something. I mean, you'll go out into the field and you'll study particular warrens of rabbits and see what they do. But then you're looking at a bigger story. So the doings of specific rabbits become less and less important. And I think if bunnies could talk, then I think biologists would write books like Watership Down. I mean, you remember that the book about the rabbits of migrating? Great book. Still one of my favourite novels. But bunnies can't talk, so we tend to look at the very big picture. And I think you can do the same with human history as well. You pull out from the details. You start to see that a lot of the stuff that conventionally takes up historians' time, it's actually all a little bit secondary. It tends to be driven by these deeper forces, hence the maps not chaps line. It's the geography rather than the individual decisions over the course of thousands of years that's driven the story.
So the next 3-4 decades are the most dangerous in human history, as you see it?
That is one of the less upbeat conclusions I come to in the book. And this is, again, driven by looking back at the history and drawing out the long-term parallels and analogies, and particularly comparing what it seems that we see now with US global dominance with what was happening with British global dominance at the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th centuries. And I think the coming 40 years are likely to be as unstable and unpredictable as the 40 years before World War I. But we take that and then we then combine it with a world where we have weapons even more devastating than we had during the 40 years of the Cold War.
And all the machine weapons. I mean, you talk about that as well.
Yeah, this is the biggest change, the computerization of warfare. And again, this, like all these things, it has its pluses and minuses. And the plus has been that the nuclear weapons were a solution to a 1940s problem. That if you want to destroy something, you fly over it with a plane, you open a hatch in the back, and you roll a bomb out the back door and hope it lands within half a mile of the target. And atom bombs solved that problem because within half a mile of the target, fine, you're still going to blow it up. The blast is so big. But now that we've got missiles that can land within like 10 feet of their targets, you don't need multi-megaton warheads anymore. And this is, I think, has been one of the big reasons why militaries have been so relaxed about reducing the size of the arsenals.
We're talking with Professor Ian Morris, and again, he's the author of a new book called War, What Is It Good For? And you may want to respond to that question. He says it's good for greater safety, less violence, and greater economic growth. If you'd like to join our conversation, we welcome your involvement, and you can do that now by calling us. Our toll-free number is available, so feel free to join the conversation. Your questions and comments are welcome. The number to call, 866-733-6786. Again, our toll-free number available now, 866-733-6786. If you'd like to weigh in or just simply join the conversation, you can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, and you can go to our Facebook page. Many ways to communicate, but feel free to communicate. This is an interactive program, and we welcome your involvement. Again, the book is called War, What Is It Good For? Conflict and the Progress of Civilization from Primates to Robots. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and we're talking with Ian Morris, who is professor of history and classics at Stanford and also the author of a new book called War, What Is It Good For? Conflict and the Progress of Civilization from Primates to Robots. He'll also be at Book Passage this evening at 7 o'clock and at Kepler's tomorrow at 7:30. If you'd like to meet the author, in the meantime, you can have an opportunity to speak with him directly by calling us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or posting any questions or comments you might have about this whole question about conflict driving human progress onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. Let's go right to your calls and start out with a caller in Palo Alto. Neil, you're on.
Yes. If your guest could comment on what I'll call internal violence or colonial violence, for example, in the British Empire age, when I think that is referred to as a period of relative peace, and comment on what I'll call the internal or colonial violence during that period and what, if any, analogies there are to the U.S. as a superpower and being a global top now and any internal violence during this period or colonial violence during this period. And I understand that we're talking in very broad swaths, but I'd be interested in hearing your guest comments on that aspect of things.
Yeah, well, a great question. And I think one of the things you see over and over again when you look at the historical record is there's kind of a pattern to the way this sort of expansion and growth of societies or states goes on. And you tend to get, when the Roman army marches into Gaul or the Han Chinese army marches into what's now Burma, you'll get this great spike of violence as the conquest proceeds. And sometimes there'll be a great uprising against it a generation later and another wave of violence. But then if you come back a couple of hundred years later, and of course the ancient empires are great for looking at this because we've got these long time scales on them. You come back a couple of hundred years later and you see this surprising result that everybody involved, the conquerors and the conquered alike, tend to be living in a safer and more prosperous world. And this is a long-term process that we see over and over again. And so when the Europeans are out conquering their global empires from the 16th century onward, again, we'll see these waves of violence, roll over the Americas in the 16th and 17th centuries, and then the beginning of a pacification. But having said that, obviously it's not all a one-way story. And when you start getting into the details, it, of course, becomes much messier.
A lot of that prosperity has to do with the fact that to the victor belongs the spoils, and the spoils often have to do with resources and a lot of things that can prop up the economy, putting people into slavery, etc.
Yeah, well, I think that the British conquest of India is actually a great example of this. Initially, it's just this plunder fest gone mad. Even the British get embarrassed about it. And in the end, they start dragging... The chief executive of the East India Company is dragged before the House of Lords and put on trial, basically for creating a wasteland and stealing everything in India. And in this case, we've got a lot of the details. We can follow what happens quite closely. And it does, in fact, conform to this general pattern that starting... in the earlier 19th century, the British are trying really hard to govern India less brutally and exploitatively, because they're figuring if we can get the Indians, well, not happy with our rule, but to just put up with it and not give us too much trouble. For the East India Company, for the British government, this is in the long run going to be more prosperous. But then what you end up with, of course, as the historian looking at this, is you get into these big debates about what does the evidence really say? I mean, how quickly did the British pacify India? Did they pacify India, for that matter? But, I mean, Neil also asked about the comparison with what the US is doing now. And I think there are just so many similarities and analogies. But one thing I think is worth keeping in mind, which I think that the history does tell you, is that compared to pretty much any earlier Globocop or Leviathan, for that matter, the US is really good at this stuff. We kill a much smaller proportion of the populations of places who get involved with than the British did, or certainly than the Romans or the ancient empires did. And in the last chapter of my book, in fact, I do a little comparison between the Boer War that the British fought around 1900 and the US invasion of Iraq in 2003, which I think they have a lot of similarities in a lot of ways. But I forget the exact numbers now, but the US version was much, much less bloody and destructive than what the British did in South Africa.
You mentioned the caller Neil, and it reminded me you have a table in here of Neil Ferguson's, who has been a guest on the show, but I was completely unaware of this. I mean, talk about it, because it's really sort of fascinating the way he tries to break things down in terms of motivation.
Yeah, yeah. I borrowed one of his tables that it's like a way of thinking about how states and empires work. And it's basically, it's a series of columns. He says you should think of it as being like a menu, that you choose one item from each column. And so one column is sort of like, how do you run this empire? Another column is who benefits from the empire. Another column is, you know, what are your techniques of integration? You know, is it military rule? Is it colonialism? Is it some kind of commercial empire? And I reproduce this table in the introduction to my book, because I think it's really useful for thinking about what, for me, was one of the biggest issues. Because, you know, my big argument is that over 10,000 years, war makes states and states make peace. They gradually pacify the world. But I got a little alarmed early on in writing the book. I thought, oh, God, am I actually saying that it really doesn't matter who wins the wars or who is in the government, that the result is still the same? But then, you know, obvious answer, the light came on the next day, thinking, oh, of course I'm not saying that. War makes a state and the state makes peace. But different kinds of governments and states are better and worse at this. And, you know, on the whole, dictatorships can be very efficient, but they do kill and gas and starve an awful lot of their own people. And democracies may be messy, but they very rarely devour their children. So the kind of government you get does make a huge difference.
More of your calls. We go next to another Neil. Good morning.
Hi. I was interested in your comment regarding the individual, the role of the individual versus the kind of the vast historical wave that produces things like World War II and talking about Hitler. And, you know, if you look at Hitler, he was a World War I vet. Mm-hmm. He represented German nationalism during the Weimar Republic, wrote Mein Kampf in jail. Mm-hmm. Yes. There really were no surprises there. And so in order to understand Hitler, you can say, yes, here was this evil genius, but on the other hand, didn't he just fit right into the historical context?
Yeah, yeah. I think you're right to focus on Hitler. And in my book, in fact, I refer to these sorts of questions as the "What about Hitler?" problem. I think you can make a really good case that if Adolf Hitler had never been born or just, you know, turned into a totally different guy, World War II would not have happened in anything like the form that it really did happen. And so Hitler, I think, is a great example of the kind of impact an individual can have if you're looking at things in the fairly short term. But I think the only way you can really think about these problems is actually, you know, going back to Neil Ferguson, who Michael mentioned a moment ago. One of Ferguson's big things has been to say that historians must think hard about counterfactuals, by which he means if you were to say Hitler causes World War II, you are implying that you think there'll be no World War II without Hitler. So if we're talking about Hitler, we say, okay, what if the Nazis had won World War II, which, you know, was perfectly possible in the early stages of the war. Was Hitler like so deviant out of the path of history that the whole history of the world would have changed direction at that point? Or in spite of all the wickedness of the Nazi regime, were they still subject to the same kind of laws of historical development, if you want to put it that way, as everybody else in the past? And I, you know, you won't be surprised to hear, very much tend to think it's a second of these. And I suspect that if Hitler had won World War II, the outcome would have been like a worse version of what we actually got, where you've got a totalitarian regime dominating most of Europe, but it's much more aggressive than the Soviets were. So I think the outcome might have been rather similar to what really happened, and the sort of pressures a victorious Nazi Germany would have been under were probably not so different from the pressures that the Soviet Union came under, which, you know, eventually forced it to change what it did.
You know, I don't know. I think about what would have happened if there weren't a leader like Nelson Mandela in South Africa, or for that matter, when you think about Hitler in Germany, someone could have, I mean, certainly a lot of the elements were there to have made a Nazi regime, but somebody else could have risen to power that didn't believe in a final solution, mm-hmm, or didn't believe in killing disabled people or homosexuals or political dissidents. China could have been led by somebody other than Mao, who was a killer, or Russia could have been led by somebody other than Stalin, who was a killer. I mean, mm-hmm. to a great extent, a lot of the murder and a lot of the internal warfare and war that went on had to do with the individuals.
Yeah, well, I think the shorter the time period you focus on, the more this is true and the more important it is. And the more you zoom out to look at things over the course of thousands of years, the more I think you find that the results eventually, it sort of comes out in the wash, in a sense, which is no consolation. If you're Jewish and living in Eastern Europe in 1946 and Hitler has won the war, it's not going to be much consolation to be told, but in a thousand years' time, it'll all work out, it'll be fine. Obviously, for the individuals living through it, we experience the day-to-day stuff in an entirely different way from this long-term history. But I think you can't understand what's really happening unless you put the long-term into the picture as well as the day-to-day.
Go to some listener emails. Lance writes, I'd argue if war creates safety and progress, one would expect African countries to be in a far better position than they are currently in.
Yeah, well, I mean, Africa is a really interesting case. Because up to the point that the European colonialists go in the late 19th century, start carving the country up, it's to a great extent still a pre-state society. You do have governments, but they tend to be fairly weak governments without much institutionalized power. And really, we've had a fairly short history since the Europeans go in there in the late 19th century. It's been a little over 100 years. And in that period, Africa, for better or for worse, has got it's been divided up entirely between governments. The rates of violent death, in spite of the horrifying news that keeps coming out of different parts of Africa, rates of violent death have gone down. Economic growth, and again, this is often gets swamped by people focusing on the doom and gloom. Economic growth in much of Africa has been absolutely fantastic. And so, I mean, I think that Africa, again, if we sort of think about where might things be in 30 or 40 years, I think Africa might turn out to be one of the great success stories.
Well, you are getting some more blowback. Let me give you some of the a few of these web postings and emails. Listener writes, Professor Morris claims the Cold War era was scary but safe. From whose perspective? The little wars of Cold War peace and Korea, Vietnam, Latin America were scary and lethal for the civilian victims and the soldiers forced to fight them.
Yeah, and of course, again, that's absolutely right. I mean, this is, it's like when we were talking a minute ago with the first Niels call about the British and India, say, and the process of pacification, how ugly this is. And yeah, absolutely. I think any period of history you look at, no matter how stable and in general terms safe a system has become, there are always strategic spots where the big powers are sort of rubbing up against each other. So, I mean, Afghanistan, I think, is a great example here because it's had the misfortune to have been a vital strategic spot in the 19th century with the British and Russians, and then to come back and have another go at being a strategic spot in the late 20th, early 21st century. And people unlucky enough to live in these places, I mean, I say Poland in the 20th century, this is just a terrible thing. These are tend to be the most dangerous places in the world.
Well, Afghanistan was even compared to a Stone Age country. They were talking about bombing Afghanistan, mm-hmm. bombing it back to the Stone Age. Another listener says, your guest does mention the hyper-policemen like England or France in the 19th century and how they oversee the flow of trade from the colonies to France and England, but your guest fails to mention the moral dimension of the story of his plot, that those who ruled India or Africa spread misery upon the autonomous population. Denmark may have a civil society today, but they use oil that leaves so much horror in its extraction, whether in Nigeria or Ecuador.
Yeah. The moral side of the story, I mean, this, I think, is where in some ways, it all gets to be even more interesting. As I think one of the big difficulties moral philosophers have had in the last few years has been coping with evolutionary narratives. And they've tended to get very interested in the sort of recent work on primates and the extent to which basic human values, what we think of as basic human values, like justice and fairness and love and honour and revenge and these sorts of things, how you can also find them in chimpanzees and bonobos and actually, I guess, in dolphins and quite a few other animals as well. And one of the things the evolutionists have tended to say is that what we like to call human values, these are evolved adaptations, that these are ways of thinking about the world that increase your likelihood of passing your genetic material on to the next generation.
I buy that, but I also think that religion does play a key factor in all this. I mean, with respect to not only giving people a purpose and making them moral and making mm-hmm. them feel that love is more important or that somehow you should not kill someone, all of those kinds of things. But, of course, it's also been used to kill people and will continue to be used to kill people and torture them and everything else.
Yes, I think that is true of so many of these cultural adaptations. They can be used to do whatever seems to pay the best results in that period. And so, of course, when Christianity comes in Europe, it aggressively preaches a doctrine of love and turn the other cheek and so on. And yet the Middle Ages are the most violent period Europe has seen in millennia.
Important question from a listener named Carson. Could you give some details on why you believe the next 40 years will be the most dangerous in human history?
Yeah, the basic starting point for thinking this is what I mentioned a few minutes back, where the sort of international relations scene bears these unnerving resemblances to what happens between the 1870s and the 1910s as the British Globocop increasingly loses its grip. More and more countries, especially Germany, but not only Germany, start saying, we want war. Very few people are saying we want war. But increasingly they're saying, well, we've got these strategic problems. We don't know anymore. We can't be sure how the British Globocop is going to act. So perhaps violence is not the worst of the options open to us. And I mean, I would say that we see a very similar calculus going on at the moment with Vladimir Putin's move into Crimea. 10 years ago, when Yanukovych got elected, his election was overturned and a much more pro-Western prime minister comes in. And Putin was in charge in Russia then and didn't do anything like what he's doing now. And I think was largely because in 2004, he could be pretty confident of a very muscular response from the US. In 2014, I think he's pretty confident that he won't have to face a very muscular response. I think these patterns keep coming up again and again. But the other big part, the response to Carson's question, the other big part of it is that unlike the 1870s and 1910s, we now do have doomsday devices. So if we have the kind of instability we saw before World War I, combined with the ability to kill hundreds of millions of people at a go, that is really scary. And the speed at which our weapons are improving is just mind-boggling.
Yeah, one of the most compelling instances in your book was when you write about that recognition that there was supposedly a missile launch coming from Montana. Mm-hmm. And a young guy named Petrov, without going up the chain of command, was ready, he thought, perhaps to respond to it and could have responded to it. And as you said, you would have been vaporized sitting there in Cambridge. And so we have it. We're talking with Ian Morris. His new book is his last book was Why the West Rules. His new book is War, What Is It Good For? Another quick question here from a listener. Says, this is from a tweet. Why do we think military action is such a drive for research and economy? Look at Germany and Japan. No military, but strong economies.
Yeah, I think military action is a driver for certain kinds of industrial and technological change and for economic growth as well. I think there's no real doubt about that. But the other side of it is, of course, the more money you funnel into military development, the less money is available to do other things. So you're distorting the economy. And you're depending on the details of exactly when it's happening. Sometimes that can be kind of a good distortion. It'll produce the military research produces more positive side effects than the more conventional use of the money would have made. Other times, though, like the Soviet Union, spending an absolute fortune on its military, and this was a disaster. It meant they almost didn't have an economy outside of the military.
Ian Morris has been our guest. Again, his new book is War, What Is It Good For? Conflict and the Progress of Civilization from Primates to Robots. He's professor of classics and history at Stanford. He'll be at Book Passage tonight at 7 o'clock, at Kepler's tomorrow at 7:30. So good to have you with us.
Well, thanks for having me on the show. I must have listened to it 1,000 times. So it's nice to be on.
It's good to be here in the flesh with you. And next, we're actually going to check in with filmmaker Ken Burns about his latest documentary, which is all about the Gettysburg Address. Stay with us. Okay, we're now joined by filmmaker Ken Burns. His new documentary, The Address, actually profiles a boarding school in Vermont where every year special needs students attempt to learn the Gettysburg Address. It airs tonight at 9 p.m. on KQED television. Let's first off hear a clip from the film, and in this clip we'll hear a student named Gio reading the first lines, and we'll hear the teacher's voice first.
We've divided the Gettysburg into five paragraphs for learning.
Read it. 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal.
Well, you did that very well. Can you tell what was going on in paragraph one, Gio, about fourscore?
How America came together.
Well, that's a clip from Ken Burns' new film, and Ken Burns is on the line here. How are you?
I'm well, Michael. How are you?
Good. Great to have you here, and excited about this because it's really quite poignant. This is kids actually talking about Abraham Lincoln and talking about the historical concept, but also memorizing what a kid says at the beginning of the film are perhaps the most stirring words ever spoken. I mean, that may be a little hyperbole, but not great in the realm of hyperbole. And this is in your backyard with Headmaster Stuart Miller. You know this school. It's a kind of rite of passage for these kids to do this, and they've done it year after year.
Yeah, it's so inspirational. I live across the river in New Hampshire from Putney, Vermont, and I was asked a dozen years ago to be a judge at this gala. These kids are given the assignment after their Thanksgiving break, and then I have to not only memorize the Gettysburg Address, which is difficult for anybody, but then publicly recite it around Lincoln's birthday. And I was so moved by their extraordinary, inspirational attempts to struggles to do this that I decided to make a film quite out of sort of the kind of films I make, but still in keeping with the power of these inspirational, stirring words that Lincoln spoke 150 years ago. And these kids do have a range of learning differences, dyslexia, ADHD, executive function, dysgraphia, a whole alphabet soup of diagnoses that make doing this a minefield. And the school itself, a boarding school for young boys, is the place often of last resort. These kids have been bullied at other places, and they come to Greenwood and sort of, you know, find a place, an LD or learning different schools are all around the country that knows how to work with these issues. They're not dumb. They have just a different route. You know, if you and I had a language-based task, and I'm going to give you one, we'd take the interstate. These kids have to, by the nature of their wiring, take a much more circuitous route, but they get there at the end, and they are just as smart and just as intelligent and just as thoughtful. But the passage, the pursuit of this is so fascinating to me that I had to make a film about it, even though, of course, the Gettysburg Address was a central part of one of the episodes of our Civil War series 24 years ago. This was another way of looking at the idea that this country could have a new birth of freedom. These kids, every year, the 35 years that the Greenwood School has been in existence, sort of escape the specific gravity of their own differences with this address, and they take it on, and it becomes a sort of living, breathing talisman. And as I was editing, trying to winnow down 320 hours of footage into an hour and a half for tonight's show, I just said, geez, if they can do it, we can do it. I made everyone in the crew memorize the Gettysburg Address. They did. And then I said, let's challenge the whole country. So if you go to learntheaddress.org, you'll see all five living presidents from Carter to Obama reading the address, and lots of celebrities, but more important, thousands and thousands of our fellow citizens who have actually memorized and uploaded their renditions to learntheaddress.org. And, you know, if you get a version of the Gettysburg Address, the Bliss version, B-L-I-S-S, is the most common, but any of the five known versions, and memorize it, you'll kind of curse me as you tape it to your mirror for a couple of days, but then you'll bless me for the rest of your life, because you'll have something on your hard drive, the way these boys have, that means something. And we live in a place where so fractured, and everything's red state or blue state or young or old or gay or straight or black or white or male or female or some sort of division. This is doing something in unison, like we like singing Take Me Out to the Ball Game.
Well, full disclosure, I learned it as a kid because I wanted to learn it because I was very enamored of it. And, you know, the guest that I just had on said to me, how do you do it? Nobody knows how you do it. You got a film about the Roosevelts coming out in the fall, yep. The story of cancer coming out in three parts, Jackie Robinson, country music, Hemingway, Vietnam. It's just extraordinary. But this is a special kind of film. It's a very different kind of film for you. And what I was struck by was just what you, getting back to what you said before about these kids being very special and inspiring, they're kids who have not only been bullied and have so-called learning problems, but are marginalized. And yet you see them doing things that really, I mean, some of the kids with music, with yo-yos, with Rubik cubes. I mean, it's pretty exceptional stuff.
This is what the Greenwood School does and all the good schools do, is that they've got it down how to treat dyslexia or whatever it is you've got, in quotes. But they want to feed your right brain. They want to know what you're good at. It's not a question of your glass being empty or half empty. It's not only half full, it's full. So let's see what you do. And I think it gives them a kind of confidence. It was great to see some of the alums of this school come back 10 years, 15 years later. The Gettysburg Address is still on their hard drive, and they're doing stuff. They've sort of pulled up, if not excelled. There's a disproportionate number of CEOs of Fortune 500 companies that are dyslexic, and that suggests that the strategies they had to employ to overcome, is that the right word, these differences were in fact so novel that it set them in better stead than perhaps the rest of us. So this country of ours, which is so advertises itself as celebrating individuality, is actually desperately wishing us all to conform, and when people don't, then we marginalize them and separate them from our pleasant view in front of us. And in fact, these kids deserve our attention. And when you think about the Gettysburg Address, this is arguably the most important speech in American history. This is a man doubling down on Thomas Jefferson's declaration, which says all men are created equal, but Thomas Jefferson owns slaves. Abraham Lincoln frees those slaves and then sets about in this 2 minutes, you know, not even 300 words, to say in the first sentence where we've been 47 years ago, where we are, now we are engaged in a great civil war, and then for the rest of the address pulls us into our future. It's said of Theodore Roosevelt that he had distance in his eyes, that he could see around the horizon. Abraham Lincoln had that same distance in his vision. He could look ahead not only in space but in time and understand where not only we should go but where we had to go and must go, and brought us there. And I think even with the absence of Lincoln, assassinated so soon after this address, less than 18 months later, and obviously just a few days after the end of the war, and exactly 149 years from today, he died, nevertheless gave us our 2.0 of the Declaration, an operating system that we are still using today. And when the first anniversary of 9/11 happened, there were no contemporary speeches. They read Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, which had nothing to do with 9/11, but everything to do with the power of words, the ability of words to remind us how we agree to cohere as Americans, and our medicine. And I think for the kids, it represents the same thing. So here you're investing almost in a Blakean sense, where you could find the universe in a grain of sand. Here at the tiny Greenwood School, 50 students, this, you know, sort of modest thing, they're able to bring us forward as well. I find it extraordinarily inspirational.
Ken Burns, award-winning filmmaker and historian, his latest documentary, The Address, airs tonight at 9 p.m. on KQED9, and he's, of course, given us so many films, The Civil War, Baseball, and so forth. And you can join him Wednesday, May 14th at the Castro Theater for a preview of his next film, The Roosevelts, An Intimate History. Tickets are available at City Box Office. I'm so sorry I can't be there, Ken. I wanted to be. You know that.
I know that.
I had a previous commitment, but I'm going to see you when you come to town in the fall.
Well, I look forward to that. And there's not a viewer that a listener that doesn't know that you memorize the Gettysburg Address, I'm sure.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.